for these men, truth communicates with reality, which is the real nature of that which he perceives with his six senses. Man continually seeks his source, the Supreme Consciousness, and those great men of your holy writings, who touched upon this source, discovered a divine plan for all mankind, one rooted in love, for the Supreme Consciousness is love. We are dedicated emissaries of this divine plan, to your planet, to those with an evolved insight, for those are the ones who will receive us. You must act with realism in the illusion as you walk in the light of the infinite mind among your people. You are an illusion or projection in a given dimension of your real self. You call it third dimensional, but this is not accurate, because you could not see, hear, taste, smell or touch unless you were, in effect, a reality, an expression in a projected form of fourth dimension. The very fact that you can think makes you a fourth dimensional being. Inanimate objects, such as tables, automobiles, houses, are in reality third dimensional. Thinking is your sixth sense and you do not have to perceive any of the five known senses to think. However, a movie, or televised picture is just as real, with the exception that the projected movie or television are merely reflection, very limited in that it does not think or control itself. It has been stated by some of your great thinkers that time itself is the fourth dimension. Time is a condition of the fourth dimension, because you cannot have time without motion, nor motion without time, and neither without thought. You, as an expressing, thinking being, are composed of both motion and time, making you a fourth dimensional thinking being. Nothing we see with our physical eyes is truth, but simply a reality in the dimension of a reflection, or an effect, secondary in nature related to a cause from a primary source. However, the mind, be it known, still thinks after the so-called death, which in reality does not exist. In truth, neither life nor death exists. Truth is. Truth never changes. Only reality, in the form of matter, energy, and time changes. Your fourth dimensional body is expressing as an instrument of your infinite spirit, through soul and mind, with the brain acting as an instrument of your mind, as a radio, or computer receives what you call electricity to activate its motions and express with music, voice or answers to problems. The electricity still exists after the radio is destroyed, although both are inferior by far to the mind and brain. Some of your metaphysicians say that you are the sum total of what you have been in past expressions. This is highly inaccurate. You can only be there, sum total of past experiences if you are fully aware of those experiences and lessons. Forgotten lessons cannot be added to the total until one is made aware of them. You are never the sum total in any given dimension. Many of your population have voluntarily reincarnated here on Earth from other planets, to help in a plan which is universal in scope. They, on their previous planets, have expressed and experienced a much higher understanding of the Infinite Father's universal laws. We have only begun to contact them and release them from a memory block, due to the lower frequency of your planet Earth. Nevertheless, we dare not interfere in the form of force or control in any way. This would not conform to the Father's laws to which we adhere. We are for progress, fulfilling to the best of our capacities, the will of the Infinite Father. To act against these laws, we realize, would turn them against us. But, this is not the reason we do not act against them. To act against them would deter progress of expression, the very progress to which we have dedicated ourselves. Many of you, the people of Earth, those reincarnated volunteers, have had quick flashes of a truth communicated to your minds originating from your infinite self, but these thoughts have been discarded as imagination, or hallucinations and dispelled from your consciousness. It is easier to do this than listen and act upon truth. It is easier to conform to the distorted ways of your world than to speak your mind and lose so-called friends, prestige, money, power, and false security. This is the difference between the men you have named Jesus, Moses, Buddha, Confucius, and many others, as compared to kings, generals, tyrants and dictators who are all in reality strategic murderers of men. Your scriptures tell of the evil of murder and persecution as evidenced by Moses and Jesus. This being against the laws of the being you call God has not changed the thinking of the people of earth. You still look up to, fear, or conform to men who have reached a high place of authority or power over their brothers. Do you think this God sanctions force, persecution, murder or evil in any form? Certainly not. Those who do, worship a false god, to suit their own ends. Son, your closest friends will shun you in the near future because of their distorted interpretations of events that will take place, but this is necessary, in the sense that it becomes part of a large screening process, all closely monitored by us, who are orbiting your planet in answer to the many prayers for help from your population of many beliefs, colors, creeds, races. We would not come to the aid of Earth unless there was a call for help on a mass scale. In the year of your time 1945 we concentrated a large group of servants of our Infinite Father, which you have called angels in your scriptures, to aid you with the help of our machines, which project thought impulses in the direction of a specified area of chaos. In our spacecraft outside of your atmosphere our instruments received, telescreened and recorded the prayers of millions of souls, desperately asking their particular God to help them in their suffering. There was a large concentration of these thought impulses in the form of prayer in the area you called Japan where your fissional explosions took place and destroyed thousands of bodies in a horrible way. In another area, your United States, thousands prayed to another god to help their armies to make haste in killing the Germans or Japanese enemy and end the war so their loved ones could come back to them. We noticed and recorded your distorted concepts of what God is with great sorrow and concern for your ignorance. On our view screens thought patterns of God took on many forms and shapes, but most were men, some with beards, some tall, some short, and of course, some were stone or wood or metallic idols. Son, we have not seen the supreme intelligence in the sense that is a particular form or shape. God is not a man. To call God a man is to limit that God. God is all, man is limited, but God is unlimited, infinite, expressing in all men, all forms. Men are student gods, going through a school of expression on this planet and many others, seeking knowledge and wisdom so that he may serve his brothers and the infinite Father of creation. Men continually progresses up the ladder toward perfection, and though a rung may break under the weight of his many errors, still his goal is to reach the top and oneness with the Infinite Father. His soul records every experience, thoughts, mistakes from the time it becomes a soul. A man's soul, as with the lower forms of life, such as dogs, cats, cows, horses, etc., is the sum total of a process of evolvement of consciousness. Everything created has a consciousness, and the consciousness evolves to the soul point, where it expresses in higher forms, man being the highest. This doesn't necessarily mean one evolves from the other, but there are many cycles of evolution. Man's infinite spirit is perfect, and uses a finite body in a given dimension possessed of a soul, the recorder, closely related to the mind, which does the thinking, using the finite brain or instrument of perception in conjunction with the five senses. What you call reincarnation is preceded by a transition or change, called death, but this is not the end of the consciousness, but a continuation of a type of experience leaving certain senses behind on the physical plane and becoming aware of more enlightened consciousness, and you discover that you are still thinking without the instrumentality of the brain. Son, I say to you that there is no such thing as death in any form, for if there were, you would not be here now, for you always were, always will be, you are, as it also is with the universe, as it is with our infinite Father of creation. Your scientists are necessary in furthering progress of all aspects of life on your planet. When science comes about, man begins to find the answers to many phenomena observed, but not understood. However, now science is actually limiting itself, and the progress of your populace, by sanctioning that which it is able to prove only through objective reality, rather than subjective reality as such, related to truth. A scientist observes visually in the course of a particular experiment an occurrence which did take place before his eyes, but, because he did not know how or why it happened, he rejects it, and it is not scientific fact until he find the answer within the scope of accepted scientific theory. He probably never will find all the answers using science in its present form, so there must come from the scientists of your day a new science, something beyond science, before progress will continue in this realm. This master of a man transmitted to me a picture of truth, but I realize my inadequacy in conveying a spiritual perception inexpressible in words. Each individual would probably interpret his message in a different way. This is the sad part of their contacting us on this earthy plane of expression, where we are very limited in interpreting mental impressions and meanings into words. The very fact of this type of relay from one medium, telepathic, to another, memory recall, is comparable to subjective reality as reflected in the form of objective reality. Thought expression is restricted to language. Telepathy is the clearest and the most direct way of communication. I have tried to recapture some of the thought impressions I received from this great teacher. The meeting with this individual has given me the encouragement and incentive to continue with my work. 3. The experiment, although I would like to take personal credit for it, I believe the space people were responsible for my performing an amazing experiment early in 1956. Of course, inventiveness runs in my family. Both my grandfather and great-grandfather were artists and inventors. I like to feel that I am similar to them in that respect. Although I had not thought too much about inventing things, early in life I had wanted to become an artist, but it was impossible for me to obtain the necessary training. Perhaps I sublimated this urge in the more prosaic occupation of sign painting. Often in the sign shop, after working hours, however, I would putter around, trying to make new things. On one such evening I had just finished a sign and was cleaning the brushes prior to going home when the telephone rang. I said, "Hello," into it, but there was no response, so I said, "Hello," several times. Still no reply, so I put it down. Immediately, however, I had the urge to lift the receiver and listen again. I did so, and there was no dial tone, the circuit was still disconnected. I listened for a few moments and was about to replace the receiver when I heard a high-pitched buzzing sound coming from it. I put it back to my ear, but after a few seconds it stopped. Then I put the telephone down and forgot about it. As I was preparing to lock up, I received a sudden and strong impulse to remain in the shop. Then almost mechanically I began to move about, pick up pieces of wood, other materials, and set about constructing something. Just what I didn't know. Whatever I was doing, I seemed to be controlled and directed, working as if I had a set of blueprints right in front of me and knew exactly every move to make. I set the materials I had assembled on the bench. Using a 24-inch plywood base, I drilled a hole halfway through the center. In the hole I placed securely the carbon rod of a broken flashlight cell. Next I obtained a large nail of like diameter and wound the nail with 50 turns of very fine copper wire. When I had slid the finished coil off the nail, the unwound ends of wire remaining measured about 8 or 10 inches. I soldered two extra connections, one from the top and one from the bottom. Two of the ends were connected to a small pen flashlight battery. I stapled some of the wires to the plywood base to hold the assembly in position. Next I took the small brass cap off the larger flashlight battery cell and glued it in the exact center of a 10-inch aluminium disc, which had been put on the jigsaw and placed in a balanced position directly on top of the carbon rod. I do remember definitely that four ends of the wire pointed at the edges of the disc directly opposite each other in the form of a cross, and approximately 1/8 of an inch from the edge of the disc. All of the equipment was set up in accordance with an imaginary shape of a pyramid. Then I made two connections at the bottom of the apparatus, which apparently completed the circuit, for the disc immediately was enveloped by a bluish, spinning light. Then, to my utter amazement, it rose from the platform, crashed through the 12-foot ceiling, which was made of aluminium paper, apparently bounced off the peak roof and then came down again through the same hole through which it had made its ascent. It crashed with more force than the weight of the aluminium would normally permit, almost completely destroying itself so far as reconstruction of that particular model was concerned. I was so surprised and shocked I sat down in complete silence and thought for several minutes. Did the electrons which came from the small battery start something in the atmosphere in the form of some type of energy which took over, once their machine had been primed? The small amount of power from the battery surely never could have moved the object in any way. I was too shaken to do any more work that night, but the next morning I tried to duplicate the experiment, without success. I just couldn't remember where I had been apparently shown to make the various connections. Later I was able to duplicate the experiment to the extent that the disc glowed, but never did it move. I am writing this with the hope that some open-minded physicist or electronics engineer will, in my brief account above, detect a key which will open the door to some type of free primary energy which the space people say is available all around us, waiting to be tapped. Some critics, hearing of my experiments, have suggested that I photographed such models while they were in flight, and their remarks amaze me, for had I been able to invent such a model which would fly, this event in itself would be almost as startling as the spaceships they accuse me of hoaxing up. The success of the initial experiments quite naturally put my mind on what one of my friends termed the free energy kick, and I stepped up my experiments with magnets, which had always fascinated me and with which I had played around in little experiments in the shop. The same friend told me one day he had invented a magnetic motor and was in the process of having it patented. I became enthusiastic, and, wishing to help him get some needed publicity, I suggested he go on the Long John show and tell his story. I asked also that he bring a model of the motor. He agreed, and I made the necessary arrangements for his appearance on the show. 2 days before the show he telephoned me frantically, saying he would have to construct a new model, and asking if I would bring some of my magnets over to his place and help him. So we went to the laboratory of a friend of his, who is an electronics engineer. There we worked several hours, but were unsuccessful in putting together a model which would work satisfactorily. That night when I went home I decided to rig up something quickly for the show, since I had promised by telegram to bring the man and a motor. So I stayed up all night, working out a system of off-balanced magnets, whereby the north and south poles of the magnets seeked equilibrium and came to a halt. To keep such an apparatus in motion it was necessary to upset its normal balance. This, I might add, was a different principle from the one involved in my friend's invention. I got my idea from thinking about the universe which is kept in motion because of its off-balance seeking an equilibrium. If it ever did reach an equilibrium naturally all motion would cease. The model I constructed for the show worked all by itself for about 2 minutes without my having to impart any work to the rotary, off-centered magnets. In my haste to construct in time for the show, however, I put it together with quick drying glue, and it broke. Since there was no time to construct a new model, I gathered up the components and rushed to the studio with them, and was able to demonstrate something of the principle involved. As yet nobody has been able to duplicate this simple apparatus, as far as I know. One of my latest experiments involved a thing people have called impossible, a one-pole magnet. The minute someone says something is impossible, I am presented with a challenge, as I was in this case. Does a magnet with only one pole refute Newton's third law of motion, which states that every force or every action produces an equal or opposite reaction? Whether or not it does, many witnesses saw me demonstrate the one-pole magnet during a recent lecture, sponsored by Dr. Alfred Smith of the Space Seekers Society in Philadelphia. As with the so-called free energy motor, a series of these magnets have turned a small direct current generator and lighted a small flashlight bulb. In my opinion, this is an example of harnessing a free energy to impart work of its own accord, generating a secondary energy in the form of what we term electricity or electrons, which, in turn, produces light energy or heat. Magnetic phenomena in the form of what we call attraction is not a pull, but a push from a surrounding unseen funnel of magnetic vortex enveloping this planet, which in itself represents a balance of motion in the form of imbalance which continually seeks an equilibrium, an effect presenting itself as secondary energy seen and unseen, originating from a cause unseen which is infinite. 4. The mystery appearance. I would like to let you in on the incredible results of one of my own experiments, and the best way to present this in detail, I believe, is to quote from one of the Long John shows, as he is interviewing Ms. Mary, January 11, 1957, LJ. This morning we are talking with Mr. and Mrs. Howard Menger of High Bridge, NJ. The young couple has appeared on my show 7 or 8 times, and they have been telling us about their experiences of having physical contacts with people from outer space. Howard had the opportunity of riding in a saucer. We also have John Otto, Cortland Hastings, and a young lady, the sister-in-law of Howard, whom we will identify with the name, Mary. Her last name will not be used, since she is going to tell us about her own meetings with people from outer space. Mary, we have never had the opportunity of having you on the party line with us, and we have been told by your sister, Rose Menger, and by your brother-in-law, Howard Menger, that you have had some rather unusual experiences in the past few months. One in particular was the teleportation of a pipe. This was described to us by Howard. Now, rather than asking any questions at the moment, suppose you just take over if you will, please, and tell us in your own words what happened when Howard teleported his pipe from Pennsylvania, the former Mrs. Menger. Mary, I was sitting in Rose's and Howard's living room and I heard this pounding on the door, and so I went and answered it and I saw Howard there. LJ, in front of the door? Mary, in front of the door. I knew Howard was in the Pocono Mountain area that night. He stared. He just stared straight ahead. He did not say anything, and he handed me a pipe. I felt very strange. I just couldn't understand how he could be there. He was. He didn't come up in any car or anything. I had this verified about 10 minutes later. LJ, what do you mean by verified, Mary? Mary, he appeared at the door at 8:20 p.m. that night, and about 8:30 p.m. he called on the telephone to verify that he had been there. LJ, now, where did he call from, Mary? Mary, he called from the Pocono Mountain area. LJ, now, how did you know he was calling from the Pocono Mountains? Mary, because of the call. It sounded far away. It was a long distance call. LJ, in other words, when you pick up a long distance call you usually can tell that it is from some distance. Mary, yes. And also I found out later that he had been seen in this diner and he had witnesses to the effect that he was at that diner, and he had them sign their names. LJ, well, now, let's just take it step by step. When the operator, first of all, was this a collect call? Mary, no, it wasn't. LJ, in other words, Howard was paying for it on his end. Howard was calling from a diner in the Poconos. Do you have any idea how many miles away from your home in High Bridge that Howard was located at the time, approximately? Mary, I don't know how many miles, but I would say it is about an hour and a half ride or a little more. LJ, now how do you judge an hour and a half as far as driving time? In other words, did you know the town he was calling from? Mary, no, I didn't. LJ, Mary, I am not trying to be facetious at this moment, but you certainly can't judge how far away he is by the tone of his voice. In other words, you would say that you thought he was talking from some distance because evidently his voice was rather low. Is that what you meant? Mary, that's right. LJ, now, you said that he was in the Poconos? Mary, yes. He said he would be home in about an hour and a half. LJ, is that how you got the idea that it was about an hour and a half ride? Mary, yes. LJ, did he return in an hour and a half? Mary, no, it was a little longer. LJ, well, maybe the roads were a little bad, and Howard, after that experience, didn't want to rush. Do you want to say something, Howard? Yes, on the way back, when I got to Washington, N.J., I went through the eastern area, that is, in Pennsylvania. I wanted to call again, but something told me not to. So I went another 13 miles or so and got to the shop in Washington, N.J., and called from there instead. L.J., now this is not the call that she thinks was from the Poconos. Oh, no, number. L.J., okay now, Mary, to get back to you for a moment. How did Howard look to you when he came? When you answered the door that night? Did he appear to be in his physical body as we know it, as he looks to us tonight? Naturally, he would have an overcoat and hat on, I assume, but, in other words, did he look the same as he looks tonight? Mary, yes, he did, but he stared straight ahead. LJ, what did he say to you? Mary, he didn't say anything, he just seemed to automatically hand me the pipe. LJ, was this a metal pipe or a smoking pipe? Mary, a smoking pipe, and he left it with me and then disappeared. LJ, when you say, disappeared, did you still have the door open, or had you closed the door? Mary, yes, I still had the door open. LJ, did he sort of dissolve, vanish, or did he walk away? Mary, he took a couple of steps and then he sort of disappeared. LJ, well, is it possible he just disappeared into the night? Into the darkness? I am not familiar with High Bridge, but in New York there are a lot of street lamps, and I do not think you could disappear too readily. You say he took a few steps, but, first of all, you say he was facing you, is that correct? Mary, yes, he was. LJ, did he have the pipe out as he knocked on the door, or did he have to reach into his jacket to get the pipe? Mary, no, he had the pipe out, in his hand. He handed it to me and took a couple of steps. Then I saw him disappear. LJ, he would have to turn around first, is that correct? Mary, I did not see him turn around. I think he took a couple of steps backward, then he just disappeared. I felt very strange. I couldn't understand it. LJ, well, you will have to get in line with me on that one. Do you remember what day this was? In other words, was it a Saturday, or Thursday? I am not looking for the exact date. Mary, December 8, 1956. We did write some dates down, Long John, but... Mary, it was a Saturday night. LJ, it doesn't matter. Now, let me continue. Do you live in the Menger's home? Mary, no, I don't. LJ, do you live? Without establishing where you live, do you live some distance away? Mary, I live 9 miles away. LJ, when did you arrive at the Menger's home that particular Saturday, approximately, in the afternoon or in the morning? Mary, I would say about 6:30 at night. LJ, and what was the purpose of coming over? Were you going to babysit that night, possibly, or just visit? Mary, no, I go there often. LJ, for supper? Mary, yes. LJ, was Howard home at the time? Mary, no, he wasn't. LJ, he was away when you got there at approximately 6:30 question mark. Mary, I think he was away, yes, he was. Rose had told me he was going up to the Pocono Mountain area. LJ, she told you that in the afternoon? Mary, when I arrived there. He told her that when he left. LJ, but he had already left. Fine. Now this was about 6 o'clock at night. Was Rose in the house with you? Mary, yes. Rose was resting,